Welcome to the Dementia Research Project. I'm Matt DeRay, and in this podcast, I explore the history, innovation, and champions in and around the world of dementia.
Sally Hopkins is the Executive Director of Eden Alternative Australia and New Zealand. She leads efforts to promote person-directed care that empowers older adults by eliminating loneliness, helplessness, and boredom in aged care communities.
How are you, Sally? Thank you so much for your time.
I'm good today. Thank you, Matt. Thank you for the opportunity to join you.
Great. Like I mentioned during our pre-call, I've been fascinated with Eden Alternative and its philosophy and all the difference it's making in the care space. Before we jump into that, I wanted to get a bit about your background and how you started and how you ended up in Eden.
My background is hospitality services, so operations and business development with large multi-corporate hospitality providers in Australia. So I live in Australia, Melbourne, Australia, and so I was involved in that sector, in the aged care sector, for a number of years through hospitality services. And, you know, hospitality is all about service. So when I was looking for a new role, I actually stumbled across this role with Eden Alternative in 2009. And it was started as a part-time job. That was the role, part-time business development manager. And I'd heard a little bit about the Eden Alternative, but didn't really know a lot. But it really dovetailed into the work that I'd have always done, which is really around people and supporting people and being the best that you can and giving good service. So I started with Eden in September 2009 and I'm still here. So my role has evolved over time. So it's not only business development now. My current title is Executive Director / CEO. So I'm responsible for the entire organisation, and we're a not-for-profit organisation. So we don't get any government funding. And we live and die on the services that we provide, which is mainly training and education around really shifting people's activity and approach to care from being institutional to one that's much more around the person. And that's where the Eden Alternative comes in. So it's a philosophy of person-directed care that ultimately looks to eliminate loneliness, helplessness and boredom, which we see every day in general population, let alone in a care setting, whether it's aged care, community care or disability services. We see people who are lonely, helpless and bored. And certainly with COVID, what that did for people globally is to identify that loneliness is real. It's not a pretend disease. It is actually a real thing. And, you know, we've been talking about the elimination of loneliness, helplessness and boredom for more than 30 years as a consequence of Dr. Bill Thomas, who was the founder of the Eden Alternative in the early 1990s. Last year, we celebrated 30 years of the Eden Alternative globally. It's a pretty big deal. Bill is also the founder of the Greenhouse Project, which is a smaller housing model. So Eden Alternative is like the operational model, the how you make the living space work, and the greenhouse model, which is about the design of smaller homes, sort of 8 to 10 people, depending on the country. In New Zealand, it's up to about 16 to make it worthwhile and cost effective as much as anything. So if you imagine that you live in a 5-bedroom house, you might add an extra 3 bedrooms, and that would be the home in the greenhouse thing. So the greenhouse being, yeah, smaller living, you know, as we would in the community if we were living with large families.
Thanks for that explanation. And I mentioned to you, I came across Dr. Bill Thomas in this amazing book called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. And it talked about how it really kicked off and how he turned a cold institutional retirement home and brought in a bit of life and innovation, which at that time, I think when he started, was a bit radical.
It was very radical. Continues to be radical in some senses, particularly when you're looking at the introduction of animals in different cultures. So in Australia, dogs are, the number one animal of choice for as a pet. But we know that in different cultures, that's not always possible in Hong Kong. We have a client there where their animal of choice is turtles, tortoises. So the residents look after the tortoises and, you know, they get bigger, let out, you know, and sometimes it's birds. So it really depends on the individual preferences and what people are used to as much as anything. Cats are also a good pet, but we know that in some cultures, cats are feral. So people have an aversion to cats, the same with feral dogs. So, you know, it really is about, in that particular part, it really is about what is works for the people who are living in the home or in their own home and what their preferences are.
Right.
So yes, he got a whole lot of birds and about 100 birds in cages, and the birds arrived first ahead of the cages, the bird cages, and they had these birds in this massive room for a night at least, and yes, caused mayhem. And yeah, the, you know, sometimes the best laid plans can go awry.
But I suppose that trial and error also led to the innovation we see in certain places today.
Yeah, trial and error. Certainly when Bill and Jude first started their alternative, it was trial and error. But what they were looking to do was to change the nursing home culture. So the Eden Alternative is about culture change. It's saying that our current, even now, 30 years later, that our current institutional practice is not humane. It's actually depressing and dreadful and not really upholding best practice in person-directed care at all. So they wanted to eliminate nursing homes. That was the original thing. So they started in existing buildings because not everyone can afford to build a new space, and that's fair enough. So how do we reconfigure the internal environment? And if we think about the transformational space that needs to occur with culture change, you're looking at personal transformation, the organisational transformation, and then the environmental or the physical space. So it would be things like the communal dining rooms, for example, or the living rooms. Instead of having everyone seated around the walls, you actually create smaller seating areas so people face each other and have a little table in the middle, or a big table depending, but they actually can have the opportunity to have conversations instead of yelling across the room. So it's a big, that in itself is a big shift, because the institutional model is the cleaners want to be able to get in, so they push all the chairs back and do their thing. All the chairs stay back. But that's not how we live our lives. You know, if we sit close to people, we pull up chairs. If we're watching the television, we're close to the television. We're not, you know, 50 feet away, even if you do have a big screen. That's just one small thing. If you're looking at someone's bedroom, now, here in Australia, we don't have too many homes where you have a shared room, but in my travels around Asia, particularly Singapore and Hong Kong, there are people sharing a room, 3, 4, 5, 6 people, which is quite different to how people generally live. But that's what's on offer. So it's like, how do you start to change that space? And really, you need to, that, well, to make it a 6-bed room, fit maybe 2 or 3, you need to then have extra spaces for other people to go and live in. And that's a hard one. You need to build more space or reconfigure and say, well, how do we create that? And, you know, there's the other side of it that says, if I'm sharing with someone I like, not so much my partner, but it could be, I might have a best friend and we just want to share the room together. Is that possible? And, you know, making that happen. If we happen to move into care together, or we're sharing, you know, living spaces together. So it is definitely transformational, the Eden Alternative, if you want to take the challenge and the journey. And it's not easy. There is no easy fix, unfortunately. Fortunately, because when you're looking at culture change and you're shifting decades of practice, it takes longer than 5 minutes, because you need to educate staff. You need to create a shared vision that really looks at what do we want our home or our organization to look like in the future? From now to the future, if what we're doing is not working, and we know it's not working, not from a humane perspective, it is from an operational control perspective. The current system of institutional care is all about control, power and control, and disempowerment. But people are wanting more control over their own lives without other people interfering, and certainly not with any knowledge about who this person is and, you know, what's their life like. And how do we enable, as providers of services, how do we enable people to continue to live their lives as much as possible with the support they need, that is balanced? You know, the care balance is really important.
I find it really fascinating, this word balance, right? Because you're talking to care home operators who've, I guess for the most part, they are commercial entities who've got profit-making objectives, right? Which could be at odds with the person-directed care to a certain extent, maybe. How do you think about that contrast in objective and incentive alignment and getting them on board? So I think the word balance here, I'm really, it's a tricky one. How do you think about that?
Look, it is tricky. If the only reason you're going into aged care is because of the real estate, then that, in my opinion, that's sort of a slippery slope to nowhere, because people will vote with their feet, effectively. If you are not providing the service quality, the care standards that people expect and or want, then you're going to end up with an empty building. So the successful providers think about, you know, as much as anything, it's a marketing, you know, but they think about how long they're going to be in the sector and what's going to differentiate them from anybody else. Because otherwise, if we're all building the same 120 bed homes that are shared, you know, rooms and whatever, and we're charging the same money, what differentiates us? And it's really about your model of care. And the model of care is mission critical to longevity and growth. And, you know, we have organisations and homes around the globe, not just in Australia. Our region covers Australia, Southeast Asia and New Zealand, who can absolutely show you the difference between an institutional home and one where the Eden Alternative is functioning really well and that the people are happy. And, you know, sometimes they're the oldest buildings ever. They're like, they've modified the existing building spaces, but they work because it's about people, you know, and the relationships that you have with people that are genuine and are real and not, you know, yes, there needs to be some level of professional relationship, because if I'm a registered nurse, I have my clinical stuff that I need to do. But at the end of the day, we are all human first. And the Eden Alternative looks at that relationship space and says, how do we support the clinical requirements, but also the relationship development? So it's that balance. So for organisations that are building big buildings, you know, unless you have your care model clearly identified and you articulate that and you practice it, it's not, you're not going to have the balance. And what we see is new operators coming in and saying, you know what, we want to do it differently. And we have a client in Hong Kong who's built a new home, multi-story, a choice of single and shared, but mostly single rooms with ensuite bathroom or a shared bathroom. And that, you know, they're innovating in terms of the beds and the internal furniture of the home, as well as training their staff to understand that their role is about people first and foremost, and really looking for the opportunities to eliminate loneliness through companionship, to eliminate helplessness through the balance of care, and to eliminate boredom through variety and spontaneity. So it's never-ending journey, I have to say.
Right.
Once you start, it's like, how long can you go? And we've got clients we've had involved with Eden for 20 years.
In that 20 years, there's been a lot of thought leadership Eden has developed. I think the important thing you touched on earlier is the plagues of, is it care homes? Boredom, loneliness, and helplessness. Yeah,
the plagues of people. You know, these are people issues in the sense of, you know, if you've ever had a moment of feeling helpless, and COVID, I guess, enabled people to feel that level of helplessness when decisions were taken out of our hands by governments, well-meaning and, you know, quite rightly, but, you know, that sense of I can't do what I want to do, you know, and the same with loneliness and the same with boredom. So the Eden Alternative has 10 principles. That provides that framework for change. That's your journey. So we identify that, you know, principle one is saying we have a problem. We have people who are dying from loneliness, helplessness, and boredom. Principle two says we need to really rethink the living space and create home with the elements of plants, animals, and people of all abilities. Principle three is the first plague, which is loneliness kills. And if you think that, you know, the World Health Organization identified that being lonely is the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day, that's a pretty shocking correlation. I don't smoke, so I'm just thinking, oh my goodness. Principle four is the balance of care, because helplessness is when we cannot do either for ourselves or what we can't do for others. And when you move into a care space, no matter what your ability, when someone's always doing things for you, you get really frustrated. And I see it when I travel a lot, and I might see someone struggling to go down the stairs, and I'll say to them, would you like some help? No, I'm fine. You know, so there's that level of control and autonomy. I'll get onto that in a minute. Principle five is around variety and spontaneity, which really adds a bit of, you know, some pep in your step. It's that I don't have something planned for today, but I'm just going to go and have a coffee, or I'm going to go to the market, or I'm just going to do what I feel like doing today rather than having it planned. It could be having takeaway tonight instead of whatever I might have originally planned. It could be walking the neighbor's dog, whatever. Principle six about meaning. What is meaningful for people? Because often we see in care homes meaningless activity, because the activity people leverage a lifestyle in their well-meaningfulness, in being well-meaning, they plan a social calendar. But it's about what they want to do. It's not necessarily what you might be interested in or I might be interested in. It's bingo on a Tuesday. It's, let's go for a van trip, whatever. But we have people living in care homes, regardless of ability, who have lots of different interests. It's like, how do we harness that interest? Principle seven is a big one, because it says that medicine is the servant of genuine human caring and never the master. And this is really where rubber hits the road, because in the institutional model, the medical approach dominates. And it's really about, I need to get your bloods tested, or, you know, take your temperature or whatever, rather than asking you, so Matt, did you have a good night last night? Did you sleep well? How are you feeling today? Before I do anything to you, I actually talk to you as, you know, this person in front of me, not a case, a clinical case. Principle eight's around empowerment, and how do we shift from disempowering people in decision-making to really enabling them to be a part of the decision, regardless of cognition. It's about that, creating that safe space where people can have a voice. And that's a big one, because that's really up against the institutional way of, I will tell you what to do and you will do it. Principle nine is really around setting your vision and having program of education and then implementation. So that's the how we're going to do it. And then principle 10 is about leadership and wise leadership, which is really looking to be open, honest, vulnerable, and inclusive, creating inclusive communities that everybody feels they're a part of the solution and not just seen as the problem. So that's your journey as a starting point. And then we have it enhanced with the Eden Domains of Wellbeing, which really is, that's your destination. So we want, well, we're looking at well-being for everybody. And the word well-being has been thrown around as a, you know, a nice to have over the last 5 years. And it's quite intangible. So if you think about identity, who am I as a person? That's more than my name. It's more than I grew up as the eldest of four. You know, it's the whole person, who, all the little things that made you who you are today. So we have identity, we have connectedness. Who am I connected to mostly? What do I connect with? Whether it's people, places, nature, animals, things, you know, stories. So connectedness. Security. Security is about trust. Yes, I want to know that the front door's locked or whatever. But it's, do I trust you as a person to do the right thing by me? And in an institutional setting, there's a lot of trust, a lot of stuff taken on trust. And when that trust is abused, we see elder abuse on so many levels, but particularly physical and chemical restraint. And then you've got financial restraint as well. Security, autonomy, decision making. Nobody wants to be told what to do. None of us want to, because we were taught as young people to learn to make our own decisions. So we did. We did that really well. And when we're then told, no, you can't make that decision, we get a little bit upset. So autonomy is a big one. And that's, you know, where the balance of care principle 4 feeds into that, because we need to get that balance, that negotiating of what's risky, what's not risky. Meaning feeds into principle 6, but again, it's the meaningful moments. What if you walk into someone's room, they have photos that they've chosen that are really precious to them, and they have a story behind them. A lot of them will be wedding photos or family photos. You know, we've got a treasure trove in someone's room when we go in. You know, what have they got that really gives us a sense of who that person is? And we need to ask more questions using appreciative inquiry approach. You know, oh, that's a fabulous looking wedding that you had. Tell me more. You know, when, what was the day? Do you know, what was the day like? You know, today's a bit sunny, but you know, was your day equally as sunny, or was it, you know, a bit cold, or did you get married here in the country, or, you know, whatever. So meaning is important. Growth and joy. Now, growth is interesting. It's really about creating the opportunities for people to feel confident that they can do for themselves and not be told, no, you can't. The message around aging is, as you age, no, you lose the ability to do for yourself. Whereas we're arguing that we need to encourage people to believe that they are able. They're more than able, actually. And that with a bit of support, they can continue to do for themselves as much as possible and practical, depending on what's going on for them. And then joy. What brings joy to your life? And sometimes for some people, it's just waking up and smelling the roses or having a cup of coffee, that first coffee in the morning, or the cup of tea or whatever. Or hearing, I did some training the other week, and one of the team members in the training, she said, what makes my day is I talk to my granddaughter every day. And my granddaughter is baby, she's 4. And she said, I say hello to her each morning, and then I wish her a good night at night. And that makes her day. You know, now if you didn't know that about her and she's living here, you might think, why is she so unhappy? It's because she's lost that connection to her family, and in this case, this precious child, because she said, I think she's a little bit like me, you know. And we would have people, if you, anyone who's had children, you hear them saying, oh, they're more like me, or they're more like my husband or my partner or whatever, you know, and it's a bit of bragging rights. And as a grandparent, which I'm not and never likely to be, I'm a great aunt, but as a grandparent, grandparents, you know, say that child is precious. As a great aunt, my nieces and nephews are precious. Different relationship. So that brings people joy, but it's the little things, you know, it's not just the necessarily the big things, it's the little things. So well-being is your destination. So the journey is an alternative, implementing the model and really embracing a new vision that says we are different. We see aging as a positive, not a negative, and that we will support people to individually have improved well-being in whatever capacity that might look like. And if we think of the well-being domains as glasses of water, if you can imagine that someone who's moved into care and they're not well known, the domain of identity will be really low. So the glass will be half full or less full. So if you think about along the seven domains, when people are knocking on the door and saying, I want to go home, who are calling out, who are walking endlessly around a home, and they're expressions of unmet need. So what is really happening for that person? So their domains at the moment would be really impacted. Instead of being full, you've probably got this domain of security is quite low. Domain of autonomy is quite low. Connectedness is like all of them are impacted because this person has an unmet need and people are not stopping long enough to think about what is actually going on for this person? Who are they that is, or what has happened? You know, and it could be, I just heard the school bell go. So let's think about some people living with memory loss and cognitive decline. And they always lived close to a school where the school bell would go and their children would be home in 20 minutes and they would always have something on the table for that child or children to enjoy post-school. They're now living in care. They have some memory loss going on and they hear the school bell and they think, my children are coming home. You know, so instead of saying your children are now in their 60s, you could say, so tell me more about your children. What sort of things do you do? You acknowledge where they're at in that space and then say, well, let's go and prepare some food for them and really honour that space of where they're meeting them, where they are now, and not thinking, you know, an institutional response would be, oh, they're just a bit stupid. They've lost their minds. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're saying. But for them, it's real. Right here, right now, my children are coming home from school. So how do we firstly honour that and then B, help facilitate something that's meaningful that can be around, I don't know, could be juice and a biscuit. So let's go to find the kitchen and let's prepare and then let's sit down. And in that preparing, it's enabling that person to then tell you more. Yeah, so it's big and it takes everybody. We just need to see our people as people first.
That's really interesting. 20 years of experiences, case studies, going to different people, care spaces. And I was wondering how that translates into the training and how your trainings have evolved. Do you mind just sharing a bit about how these learnings are disseminated through courses and maybe a bit of an example of how one has actually been impacted in the field?
We do have a range of education products. The foundation training is a 3-day Eden Associate course, which we teach to in-house groups. So that's when we go on site and we teach a group of people. Or we have an open session where we hire a space and people come and they want to learn more about the Eden Alternative. And that's the deep dive into the 10 principles. And it's how do we... because it's about personal transformation. If we cannot expect other people to change if we're not prepared to change for ourselves. And I was actually a participant. When I first started with the organisation, I did the Eden training as a participant. And I thought I had a handle on this. And I got to Principle 4 and, you know, the balance of care. And I had an aunt at the time who was living in care. And I thought, oh, my God, I take over. When I go and visit her, I actually take over. It being the, you know, the well-meaning niece. And I thought, I need to actually sit on my hands. So that was my first aha moment that really knocked me for six. And then the second one was around empowerment and the organisational chart. And if you think about organisations, they have these beautiful glossy structures of, you know, CEO and clinical manager and operations manager and all that sort of stuff. And it looks a bit like a tree. going the wrong way. Nowhere do you see the clients mentioned. The residents are not there. If it's residential care, it's the same with disability services, and even in community care, it doesn't include your clients. So we have this disconnect between what we're there for and who we are. You need to mesh it together. So I just went, oh my goodness, what are we here for? We're here for people. We're here for people who need support. So that was my own personal transformation, just, you know, and as we teach the 3 days, we do adjust depending on the culture of the organisation. So we've been teaching in Singapore and Hong Kong in the last few years, as well as Australia, New Zealand. And while there are similarities, there are some differences, not a lot. But, you know, when you're looking at the physical environment of care homes in, say, Singapore and Hong Kong, where there are, you know, 4 or 5 beds in a room, that's a bit hard to create, you know, change, but you can do some different things. So really we take you on a personal journey, because it starts with us. Any change in culture starts with us, and we need to be seen as part of the solution and not seen as part of the problem. So the implementation then, at the end of our 3 days, we have a post-training project that people create using the tools that they've learned. And one of the best things is that we teach is what we call a learning circle or a sharing circle, where all your meetings are held in a circle with everybody, and there's a topic and a facilitator, and you really create a foundation of trust. Because in an institution, we don't hear many voices. We only hear the noisy ones. We don't hear the silent ones. We don't hear the ones who are tentative. Whereas with a sharing circle approach, everybody has the opportunity to say, this is what I think. So that's a shift. That's a significant shift just in practice. So what we want people to do is take the theory and put, using the tools, put into practice the things they've learned that really start to impact on them and also the people that they're caring and supporting. And I'm just receiving some growth work from people at the moment, post-training growth work, and the teams who did the training are saying, oh, I was a bit nervous to actually ask, you know. So we have this, you know, this fear that what's going to happen, they'll be mean to me or they won't answer. And I've never had anyone who said to me, I did my learning circle and it was a mess. What I get is, I did my learning circle and I learned so much with my question. And it can be any question that you genuinely want to know the answer to, you know. And it could be, you know, well, some of the questions that come through are quite amazing. What makes your day? What makes your day? And that's different for everybody. That could be today's question. When we do handovers from one shift to another, instead of focusing on what's wrong with the person, talk to the team and say, so what's Matt done today? Oh, Matt's been really busy. He's been in the garden. He's been assisting with the. And so by the time that Matt gets to 2 o'clock, he's going to be a little bit tired potentially. He's now 90. Just so. But it's the different conversation. You know, so we're focusing on the person first, and then we're supporting him or her to do different things. So it's a shift in thinking and a shift in, instead of just doing everything, it's really also having those opportunities for being in that space and taking the opportunity to just to learn a little bit about that other person. And what I do notice is that younger people, if they don't have older people in their lives, they're actually quite frightened of old people. They don't know how to have a conversation with that person who's sitting there who looks really lonely, but I don't know how to start the conversation. So we provide some tools and ideas and tips, because our intergenerational relationships are really quite important. Well, they're not quite, they're very important, because our elders teach our young people how it is to be living in this world and what are the challenges. And I did a sharing circle with a group of volunteer students at a home a number of years ago now, and I asked them what they loved about volunteering at this home, and, you know, got lots of different responses, but a couple of them were outstanding in terms of memory. It's living history. I don't have grandparents. I come in on my school holidays because I miss them. And then one young woman who said, her name was Grace, and she said, she's 17, she's a bit older than that now. She said, I now know what I'm going to do with my life, with my career. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, I thought I understood what it meant to be old. But what I've learned coming here is that being old is about, it's about learning, it's about sharing, it's about recognizing and respect that this person in front of me knows a whole lot more than I do. And I can learn from that, and I want to be a gerontologist. And that was at 17. And so she's gone off and done a double degree in the States and whatever else. So with the power of, you know, the opportunity for intergenerational relationships is underestimated, you know. And the elders want to feel alive. A young child makes them feel alive. You know, whether they're wriggling on their laps or sitting in front of them playing with some others, they think, I remember my time when I had my children that age.
You mentioned earlier some of the cultural differences here in Asia. I'm wondering, are there any learnings or opportunities you see? I do think, like, sometimes these constraints, they breed creativity.
The cultural differences are usually around assumptions. And like when I say to people I'm teaching in Hong Kong or Singapore, and they say, oh, well, why would they want something like the Eden Alternative? You know, that, don't they treat their, you know, look after their elders? And I'm actually saying to them, well, that may have been the case in the past, but what we're seeing is a middle class that's rising, and they either don't have time or they don't want to have time to support their older people. So they're looking for residential care where mum or dad or grandma or grandpa can live because they can't support them. So we're seeing a shift in that cultural identity space of, in the old days, you had your grandparents living with you, or yeah, they were next door, like they were very close. You lived close together and you would see each other, if not every day, then certainly every other day or once a week or whatever. So that's changed. Now that's not a good thing, I don't think. So there's the perception of what we think happens, and then there's a reality. So there's that start. So when someone moves into care, they've lost all their connections. And another assumption is around, how do we call out, what names do we call our elders? Now, you know, the terms auntie and uncle are lovely. And I know as a child I grew up and all our neighbours were called auntie or uncle, whatever, is an honorific. And certainly in Asia, auntie and uncle are used not infrequently. But what's the person's name? Because if you were to call me auntie and we don't have a relationship, I would probably say to you, that's not my name. One example. So when we actually ask older people, what's your preferred name? They will surprise you. And it might be, you know what? I've always been Dr. Tong. I want to be called Dr. Tong, not uncle or auntie. You know, so that's just one example. And then if they say, you can call me auntie or uncle, that's fine. We've been given permission to call them by their preferred name. So, you know, just that in itself feeds into identity and really shows a mark of respect. So there's that. And then there's the whole thing around dining and eating and choice. And so a lot of our elders would have gone to the market every day to choose whatever's going to be on the menu because refrigeration was limited. Changed a bit now, but let's talk about then and now. And so they're moving to care and they've lost that capacity or the ability to be able to go to the local market and to choose some fruit, for example. It's then thinking, well, how do we enable that to happen? Do we bring the market in, which is quite possible, or is there a market stall outside the home where someone can go down and spend a a little bit of money and buy some fresh bananas or whatever they want. So you create that connection that we need to reconnect people with their communities, and what they lose when they move into care is that connection to community. So all these different things we talk about in the training is how do we start to reimagine what living here can look like. And for staff, I know we discussed this yesterday, but I'm going to say it again. In the training, I often ask people, if you needed to move into care tomorrow, would you be prepared to do so? And in most cases, the answer is no. So, you know, what we are doing is not right, because if it's not good enough for us, then why is it good enough for this particular cohort? And if that's the case, if you know is your answer, then we have work to do. Genuine work to do. And it's not a failure, but it's a lack of understanding that we are supporting our future selves. And I get it, when someone's in their 20s and 30s, you can, and I imagine that you're in your 70s or 80s and you may need support, or even 60s. And I'm not wishing any bad health on people, because it's, you know, pretty awful when it happens. But if what we want is not what we're doing now providing, then we need to change. And we need to change the system. And so our training helps with that. And the other two courses that I will touch on briefly, we have 2-day Dementia Beyond Drugs, which really looks at how do you provide support for someone living with dementia that is less around the prescribing of medications and more around what's meaningful for that person and who they are, and looking at a wellbeing approach. And then this third one, which is newish for us, is a 2-day leadership course, the Elevating the Science into an Art. And that is pretty extraordinary about how do we develop our leaders, because we need to not only identify leaders who seem to have a natural penchant for leading people, but give them the skills to actually help to change the culture. And we look at how do we make decisions. You know, we look at someone and we decide in nanoseconds whether we do or don't like the look of that person, just as an automatic. That's what happens. We don't even realize we're doing it. So we look at that decision making, and you know, which side of the brain is, you know, more dominant than the other, and whether you're, you know, given permission, how confident you feel, how you work as a team member. Now, there is no I in team, and I know it's an old cliche, but it's absolutely true. And in aged care and community care and resident disability services, we need people working together as a cohesive team. And if you've got a shared vision, that's a whole lot easier than I'm just here to do my job, because there's no joy in that really. And people are then in the institutional setting, when I'm just here to do my job, I'm so busy, I haven't got time to go to the bathroom, let alone have lunch. But if I'm working as a team and we know that we're down one or two people, then let's work out as a team what really needs to happen today. And let's work with the elders and say, what's really important to you today? Because I'll tell you what now, it's not going to be the shower. You know, no one's died from not having a shower every day. But people seem to think that bathing needs to happen every day. Now, you know, in hot countries, I get that. But it doesn't necessarily have to happen at 8 a.m. every morning. And we've got homes where they've eliminated the shower lists. You might think, how would I have a shower list, Matt? Well, let me tell you, they exist. And your shower days are Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and they're at 8 o'clock. And woe be tired if you're not ready. Whereas, you know, some days, even when we live where we live, you might have a shower before breakfast or after breakfast or when you've been to the gym, whatever. It's pushed out because there's other things that get in the way. So we need to have the rhythm of daily life, establishing what happens in the home and the people who live in the home, the people that need to be part of that decision making and not seen as the problem.
You mentioned earlier culture change. What are some of the, I suppose, signals that everything that's being done is working? And I guess, how do you think that translates into a bigger conversation around system-wide change, right? Because a lot of these things happen at the community levels. Because when you hear these testimonies, I'm sure it almost seems like undeniable, right? But how do we get that wider mass adoption of some of these very, I guess, fundamental principles around healthy aging and well-being?
It's the $64,000 question. I think part of it is being open to other opportunities and other messages. I mean, if I think about when I walk into an Eden home where the model is working really well, some things you will see is you'll just see happy faces. You'll hear a lot more noise. It will feel different. And I know that's really, it's hard. It's an intangible. But they're real. When you're recruiting staff, so some things that we would see on the interview panel, you have residents or clients who are on the interview panel because they are the end users and they've got a vested interest in making sure that you, Matt, as a personal care or an RN or whatever role that you play, that I can rely on you. So the residents are looking for a different skill set. As an employer, I'm looking for, you know, do you have the skills to do the job? And the resident's going, are you going to be nice to me? Can I rely on you? Do I trust you? Different things, a bit hard to measure. So the interview panel is a big shift. As a consequence of that, residents have input and they have vested interest. They go, Matt, oh, great to see you've been appointed. That's fantastic. And can I show you da-da-da-da-da? So you have that automatic connection and they want you to be successful. No one really wants people to fail. When you have that sort of culture, and I've heard it from different people who've experienced being on an interview panel with residents, they just go, oh my God, it was just amazing. And it just shifts people's minds about this place is different. So you need to walk as walk as you talk. In the induction, it's really looking at how do we get to know the welcoming process for people who move in as residents or who start as new staff is like, how are they made to feel welcome? What are their well-being needs? Why do they want to work? A lot of Eden homes record having either waiting lists for residents to move in and or a surplus of applicants when they're needing to recruit staff. And when you say we are practicing the Eden alternative and implementing it, that's a differentiator. And when you're asked to do some research, that's a flag to go, you need to do some research. Because at the interview panel, if I ask you, Matt, what do you know about the Eden alternative? And it was a requirement before you came to, you know, have something and you haven't done the research, then it's an end of the conversation. So you start to self-select, in fact, people who are interested in doing things differently. So right at the beginning, you know, so there's the organisational vision, mission, values statement and saying, the Eden alternative underpins our strategy as the model of care. This is what it means in being prepared to commit to staff training particularly and to really challenge the way things have always been done, because it's very easy to say, well, we've always done it this way. Yeah, but is it working? And often it's not. So being open and then including the families and the external community in what you're doing. Families often feel disenfranchised because they think that they're not welcome. They're seen as more of a problem than anything else, which is furthest from the truth. So when you include families in the vision that you're creating, then they go, okay, I get it. And then what's their role? How can they help this home to be better than what it is now? So the Eden alternative is saying, let's build on the good stuff that you're already doing, because there is some really good stuff happening across the sector globally. But I know we can do better, and it's really around the relationships that we have with people. And when we know our people better, beyond the care plan and what's wrong with them, we have untold opportunity, because the greatest resource in our care homes and community are the elders.
This has been a really insightful conversation, Sally. So thank you for that. I think I'll end with like maybe two final questions. First one is, What's next for Eden? Like anything, any big plans in the future? And lastly, how do people reach out? Because I suppose my hope for the people listening to the podcast is they go to the website and learn more as a starting point.
All right, so what's next? Okay, we're presenting at the International Federation of Aging Conference in Cape Town in September, doing two presentations, one around the domains of wellbeing and the workforce, and really looking at leadership and saying, how do we retain staff? And part of it's about understanding what the wellbeing needs of our staff are from a workforce perspective. And globally, we have a workforce shortage in the sector. So there's that. So a bit more of that. And then really looking at other opportunities to move into different countries around Asia, maybe Malaysia, Indonesia. We have had people who've attended our training at open sessions. So we'll have some training online, not online, on our website to do with different countries in the next 6 to 8 months. People can reach out by sending an email through our website. There's a contact page there. And really looking at, for me, the message now is around creating inclusive communities, that we look at not segregating people by their disease, e.g. we have a group of people living with dementia, but we actually create a home space where it's what I call a blended community. So no matter what your disease is, your disability is, you are included in that space. So that's more building on the foundation of the Eden Alternative, because we cannot be segregating people because of their diagnosis of dementia. It's an abuse of human rights, really. It's the only cohort we actually lock up through no fault of their own, but they happen to have a devastating disease. And it's not like that person has lost their mind overnight. In fact, they don't lose their minds, they just lose their abilities. And how do we enable that person to continue to use what ability they've got left? You know, we backfill the bits they can't do and celebrate the stuff they can do. I mean, our training is always tailored to the culture. We did some training in Macau recently in April. We actually had a translator who spoke perfect Cantonese and brilliant English, and she was a treasure. And, you know, that enabled us to be able to communicate. We had the translator because a core group of people of the group were not English speakers, so she was a really good bridge. So we're moving into a bilingual document at the moment of English and probably Cantonese or simplified Chinese at the moment. Now, that was never on my radar 3 years ago, and now we're looking at that sort of multilingual space so that we can train. So one of the things we are doing is training in-country teams. That's my current challenge. In-country teams who can teach the Eden Alternative in the local language, because I speak only English to my regret, and I'm learning a little bit of Chinese, but for example, but no. So we need to create teams, which we're in the process of doing, but that takes time. It's not a case of here's the manual, off you go. You actually need to experience it first and then take your teaching style, your education style, and say, how do I weave in the stories that are culturally in context with people living in Malaysia, for example, or Indonesia or Singapore? How do we bring in the best bits and build on a future where the elders are at the top of the tree?
Thanks, Sally. I learned a lot during this conversation. I am sure the audience will too. I look forward to see how the rest of the journey unfolds.
Thank you, Matt. It's been fun. It's been really, really good. Talking about the alternative, which, you know what, it's for everybody. It's not just for people living in care.
Thanks for listening. If you want more of these type of stories, interviews and guests, please follow the Dementia Research Project wherever you get your podcasts. Onwards and upwards.